Hello and welcome back to Doc Talk. Beyond vaccination, what are some methods for treating COVID-19 in both inpatient and outpatient settings? In the 2 years since the beginning of the pandemic, the strategies for protecting people from this deadly virus have certainly evolved, yet questions remain regarding COVID-19 therapeutics and their availability in certain communities and during times of scarcity. For this episode of Doc Talk, Dr. Tara Vijayan, who is a member of the Division of Infectious Diseases at the David Geffen School of Medicine, offers insights into the mechanisms of several COVID-19 treatments, as well as the primary outcomes of these treatments in clinical trials and how they influence prioritization. This conversation is based off of her PrimeMed West 2022 session, Navigating Novel COVID-19 Therapeutics in Times of Scarcity and Beyond. Though she's confident with certain aspects of COVID-19 care, she's also focused on improving upon treatment from, quote, an equity standpoint, an ethical standpoint, and an evidence standpoint.
To just start things off, can you give a brief overview on the keynote address you made during PrimeMed West 2022?
Sure. So essentially, what I had spoken about was an overview of our treatment options for COVID-19 over the last 2 years and how they've evolved. And I focused on both treatment in the inpatient setting as well as in the outpatient setting. This was targeted to our primary care doctors. So I spent a little bit more time really focusing on the outpatient treatment. But essentially, the frame of my talk really focused on the way we approach treatment from an equity standpoint, an ethical standpoint, and an evidence standpoint. So I went through why it's important to target specific populations that are at particularly high risk for severe COVID and for hospitalizations. I talked a little bit about what the goal of treatment was. So in the outpatient setting, the goal of treatment is really to prevent hospitalizations. That's what all the studies were actually focusing on. Whereas in the inpatient setting, the goal was to prevent progression of disease and death, you know. Thinking about how these studies were actually conducted and what outcomes they were measuring is really important to when we think about what our goals are for treatment for certain individuals.
Great. So how comfortable are you with the current stable of treatments? Because obviously this has been a long way to here, and there's been misinformation about potential treatments in the beginning and probably throughout. And then we did have some successful treatments come through. And I'm not sure everyone is aware of all the successful treatments that we have now. So are you comfortable with what we have, or do we still really need to find some new suitable treatments?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm comfortable with certain aspects of what we have, which is, you know, if our goal is to really reduce the number of patients that are in the hospital, I think we have some really nice options in the outpatient setting. And even in among those who are hospitalized, I do think that we've come a long way in terms of preventing people from dying if they are hospitalized. I think the next steps will be really to look at treatment as a form of prevention, right? So in addition to the vaccines, among those who are actually infected, is there a role for certain types of antivirals to prevent transmission, for example, or to reduce the number of days of symptoms so that people can go back to work earlier if they feel like they're ready to go back to work. Those kinds of things, I think we don't really have those data. I think that the current antivirals are really hard to scale for that kind of outcome, you know, for multiple reasons.
Okay. Now, regarding COVID-19 stewardship, what has been the role of pharmacists in aiding primary care physicians prescribing?
The pharmacists are an incredibly important part of our process of prescribing antivirals. And specifically, I would say with Paxlovid, which is a drug that has many drug interactions, it's really helpful to actually collaborate with our pharmacy colleagues who are experts in looking at drug interactions. I do think that it's a bilateral partnership. So, you know, the clinician brings to the table specific knowledge and specific understanding of the patient's clinical condition, and the pharmacist brings to the table their understanding of the pharmacokinetics, the pharmacodynamics, and the and specifically the drug interactions. So there should be a dialogue between the two. There's no question that the pharmacists are really integral in this process.
Now, what new issues and resolutions in treatment allocations have emerged during the pandemic? And can how we resolve these issues in a situation like COVID be seen as kind of a guide for other situations in medicine that have these disparities?
I guess what this is maybe alluding to is scarcity, our issues of scarcity that we have had historically, and we will have, you know, this is an ongoing issue, not just with novel therapeutics, but even with drugs that we've had for a long, long time. We're actually in the middle of something, a gentamicin shortage, which is a drug that we use a lot in the inpatient setting. So drug scarcity is going to be an ongoing issue, and really prioritizing individuals who are at highest risk is really important, as well as both highest risk for progression, as well as highest risk for exposure by virtue of being in certain communities that have lower access to certain resources. So I think that we've come a long way in this area. You know, LA County in particular, initially when they received Paxlovid, was specifically distributing Paxlovid to lower income neighborhoods that had less access to care. And so they were really trying to get these patients, and perhaps, you know, less access to vaccines, or were more reluctant to actually get vaccinated due to mistrust. So they were trying to get those individuals, again, who are at highest risk of actually becoming hospitalized, access to Paxlovid. I guess my overall feeling about this is that there has to be an ongoing conversation between the frontline physicians and clinicians who are on the ground, public health, you know, who's actually overseeing the distribution of this, and the patients, you know. So there has to be messaging that goes across the board that really emphasizes getting these drugs to the patients who are at highest risk, really reserving these drugs for the patients who are at highest risk, not necessarily giving it to, you know, a fully vaccinated 25-year-old who has no other medical complications, because that person is really not going to derive benefit the way other people might derive benefit. So,
okay. Now, you spoke a little bit about drug scarcity. I guess that kind of goes hand in hand with some of the misinformation on whether or not certain drugs like hydroxychloroquine would work against COVID. When something like that happens, how important, how do doctors fight this misinformation? And how do you ultimately, the goal is to prevent a run on these drugs for COVID, where it doesn't actually help COVID, when they are needed to treat other diseases for patients?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I think we're sort of in a time where there is information is so easily accessible in so many different sources. So it's impossible to control what people are seeing. But as long as we as clinicians are consistent with our own messaging about this, and, you know, it's very hard, I think, for a lot of people to say no sometimes when they have a patient who is insistent. That encounter can take, to really have a meaningful dialogue with that person is going to take 30 minutes, 40 minutes, maybe an hour to really convince them, to show them why hydroxychloroquine is actually not the right drug, you know? But that's not time that everybody is afforded. So I think that it really does require, from a systems level, some system support for these clinicians who are on the ground, having these conversations to really support them in their decision-making process, and maybe even allow them in certain situations to give them the time to have these meaningful conversations with their patients.
Now, many agents designated for COVID-19 care, including antivirals and monoclonal antibodies, are hugely dependent on the timing of the disease, diagnosis, and allocation of resources. What has been the primary care physician's role in facilitating care in these scenarios?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think making ideally physicians should be able to know in real time when their patients are actually symptomatic, you know, whether it's through whatever portals, whether it's through some other kind of telephone triage system. I mean, you know, I'm always loath to put the entire burden on the clinician because it really is a team effort. So if there are, for example, I mean, I know systems actually, for example, smaller clinics where they will actually review all of the patients who have positive COVID tests, and then they will do outreach to the clinicians who care for them, just letting them know that their patient is positive. And then there'll be a conversation about whether a specific antiviral is actually appropriate for that patient. And then there'll be out, and then they'll either prescribe it or they'll refer them to for monoclonal antibodies. We actually have a partnership with Venice Family Clinic where that exact process takes place. So it's, you know, I think the primary, the way in an ideal world that this would work is that as soon as a positive test popped up, a group of individuals identified if they were at high risk or not for progression, and then notified the clinicians and, you know, and got them to consider one of the antivirals that are available.
Okay. Now, what I want to say, honest misrepresentations of COVID-19 clinical trial data are patients generally making, and how can frontline clinicians be prepared to correct misconceptions and misinformation?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think I don't know what specific clinical trial misinformation there may be. I mean, I think maybe there are some ideas about what was actually being measured. You know, I've sort of seen a little bit of chatter about this idea that they're keeping this information from us, and you know, we all can benefit from this treatment. You know, those sort of details, I think, are you know, are sort of what I've seen permeate, at least in social media. I certainly think that, you know, vaccine information is often misrepresented, and there's this idea that there are adverse effects that are not reported in these clinical trials. So, I mean, I think ultimately, you know, it's hard to counter misinformation with a lot of information because I think it can be overwhelming. But I think really bringing it back to the patient, trying to get them to, you know, think about who else in their network actually has gotten treatment or who else in their network has actually been vaccinated, trying to really get patients to think about their own social networks in a more meaningful way, I think may improve trust overall.
And now the emergency use authorization label has kind of taken a greater life of its own during the COVID-19 vaccine approvals, as well as treatment and diagnostic regulation. How has it impacted primary care prescribing and referral strategies, the EUA?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there are different there have been different EUAs over the last 2 years, you know, so when there was an EUA for repurposed drugs like hydroxychloroquine, that basically gave permission for a lot of people to wind up prescribing hydroxychloroquine, even with very little data. The newer EUAs, I think, are a little bit more challenging because, you know, each EUA actually ensures that patients should receive a fact sheet. And that barrier, I think, is actually hard for a lot of frontline clinicians, you know, to give their patient the fact sheet to make sure that they go through it. They're essentially trying to consent these patients for these drugs. What we've found is that the clinicians often defer having that conversation until the patient comes to either pick up the prescription or comes to actually get the monoclonal antibody. So the staff that are actually overseeing that end of the process wind up doing a lot of the education. And in our experience, that's not always as effective because patients have a stronger relationship with their clinicians. They would rather actually talk to their clinicians about it. So, I mean, I think from a systems perspective, allowing clinicians to have the time to have these conversations and make them understand that these are drugs that are still relatively investigational. There were a good trials, for Paxlovid, 2,200 patients were enrolled in that trial. There are certainly trials that have a lot of patients that have been enrolled, but making sure they understand that the goal of the treatment is to prevent hospitalization. There are some side effects, and these are just the things to monitor. All those conversations are conversations that really should be happening in the, either via telephone or by email or any number of things.
We'd like to thank Dr. Vijayan for being a part of the program, and thank you so much for listening. If you want more COVID-19 news, make sure to follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook. We'll be back next week with a special episode of Doc Talk from ATS 2022. Until then, stay safe and stay healthy.